Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Steve Edkins. I'm a postdoc at Stanford, but today I'll be talking about work I did for my PhD thesis with Seamus Davis at Cornell. So before I get started, just want to acknowledge a few people. The work I'll talk about today was done in collaboration with Mo Hamidian, who's now a professor at UC Davis. Our theory collaborators, Michael and Una, who are here, and I'd like to thank my PhD advisors, Andy McKenzie and Seamus Davis. So, sorry? Oh, yeah, yeah. Seamus doesn't like photos in color of himself, I think. He always goes black and white. Anyway, so the question that will motivated the work that I'm talking about today was, is a pair density wave causing translational symmetry breaking in cuprates? So what's a pair density wave? Well, in 1964, Fulda, Ferrell, Larkin, and Achinikov predicted a new state of matter, and that was a superconductor where the pairing amplitude modulates periodically in space. And this has subsequently come to be known as a pair density wave. So how might that happen? Well, to understand that, first we should back up a little BCS. And their thesis was that a superconductor is a condensate of spin singlet Cooper pairs with zero center of mass momentum. So a quasiparticle with spin up momentum k pairs with a quasiparticle with spin down momentum minus k. The Cooper pair has zero center of mass momentum, and that means that the pairing amplitude is spatially homogeneous, or you could say the Cooper pair density would be spatially homogeneous. FFLO considered a different problem, which was a metal in a large magnetic field which spin splits the Fermi surface. Now quasiparticles can no longer pair with their time reversed partners, but a quasiparticle with momentum k spin up can pair with one spin down momentum minus k plus q. But now the Cooper pair no longer has zero center of mass momentum. Now it has momentum q. That means that the pairing amplitude modulates periodically in space with wave vector q. And to date, there has been no direct detection of an FFLO or PDW state. Pair density waves have been proposed or predicted in cuprates for a number of reasons, but here it's not driven by the presence of a large magnetic field which spin splits the Fermi surface, but rather by the intrinsic interactions or correlations in the copper oxide plane. And this idea has really gained traction due to two main experimental observations, which John mentioned. The first of which is in LBCO at 1/8 doping in the stripe phase, it appears that two-dimensional superconductivity within the planes onsets at a temperature much higher than 3D superconductivity. And one plausible way of explaining this is that it's due to a pair density wave causing frustration of the Josephson coupling between the layers and suppressing the 3D TC. Another proposal comes from, another reason comes from Patrick Lee, who was looking at ARPES data from ZX Shen's group on BISCO 2201. And he argues that the antinodal gap, as seen by ARPES, is inconsistent with a CDW or uniform D-wave pairing, but is consistent with a pair density wave. But what would be nice is if we had some probe that allowed us to directly detect spatial modulations in the pairing amplitude. So one way we might be able to do this is using what we call scanned Josephson tunneling microscopy, where you directly access the condensate using the tunneling of Cooper pairs from a superconducting STM tip into a superconducting sample. And as a function of position on your sample, what you do is measure current voltage characteristics, and you look for the maximum current of Cooper pairs, or the Josephson critical current. We know that the Josephson critical current is proportional to the amplitude of the superconducting order parameter. So if I can measure the Josephson critical current with nanometer resolution, I can make a nanometer resolution map of the order parameter. Now, to enact this in, or to realize this in cuprates, the first thing we wanted was a superconducting tip with a very large gap. And we also needed it to be a D-wave gap so that we could tunnel into the D-wave condensate in the cuprates. So the way we did this is to take a normal tungsten STM tip, an optimally doped BISCO2212 sample, and then we just smack the tip into the sample. And you hope that you pick up a piece of superconductor. And sometimes you do, and it remains superconducting. And furthermore, it's pretty small. The flake is nanometer size, so you have nanometer resolution. And when you do this, the tunneling spectra and the topography change in exactly the way we'd expect if you had picked up a piece of superconductor. Now what I'm showing are a series of current voltage characteristics as I move my superconducting tip sequentially closer towards the surface of my sample. But it turns out that for Josephson junctions that are this small, the thermal fluctuations of the phase, as well as quantum fluctuations of the phase because of the charging capacitance of the junction, are so large compared to the Josephson energy that you don't get any DC Josephson effect. So you don't see any supercurrent of Cooper pairs. But this regime of Josephson tunneling is well understood. And what you do see is some small but non-zero resistance for Cooper pair tunneling near zero bias, which is shown by this small slope here, or this finite slope, sorry. And you see a maximum current of Cooper pairs, which we call IC. This maximum current of Cooper pairs, IC, is proportional to the square of the intrinsic Josephson critical current, IJ, which means it's proportional to the square of the order parameter, or equivalently the superfluid density. So if we can measure IC with nanometer resolution, we can measure the superfluid density with nanometer resolution. So that's what we did. We took a BISCO2212 sample, optimally doped, temperatures 50 millikelvin, and we scanned our superconducting tip around the surface and took current voltage characteristics and extracted IC to make the first nanometer resolution images of the superfluid density. But having done that for the first time, we wanted to, in a model-independent way, or empirically ascertain that we were, in fact, faithfully measuring variations in the superfluid density. And something that allows us to do this is the fact that we have zinc impurities in our sample. Zinc impurities are known from USR studies to suppress the superfluid density in a region of a few nanometers around them. And we can independently image the location of these individual zinc impurities through their characteristic single particle tunneling resonance. So everywhere in this DIDV map I'm showing here, every black spot corresponds to a single zinc impurity. And if you compare that with our map of the superfluid density, you see everywhere there's a black spot here, you have a strong suppression of the superfluid density. In fact, it's around a 95% suppression. So I take this to be a strong empirical validation of the fact that we are faithfully reproducing variations in the superfluid density. So having validated the method, the next thing you might want to do is ask what else is in this map of the superfluid density. And you might be able to see that there are some periodic or wave-like features in it. And as in any situation where you have periodic signal in your data, it's always useful to take the Fourier transform. So that's what we did. And you see there are clear peaks corresponding to 4-unit cell periodic modulations of the superfluid density along the copper-oxygen directions. So it's the first example of directly detecting a periodically modulating superconducting condensate. So this periodically modulating superconductor might remind you of the paired density wave I motivated this talk with at the beginning. So the question is, have we detected this? have we detected a new distinct phase of matter? Well, the way we classify phases of matter is through their broken symmetries. So let's think about that. If I have a uniform superconductor, because we do in this case, we're deep in the superconducting state at 50 millikelvin. If I have that coexisting with a modulating component, a pair density wave, that breaks global phase or gauge symmetry and translational symmetries. If I had a uniform superconductor coexisting with a charge density wave, well, that also breaks global phase and translational symmetries. So if you have a uniform superconducting component, then you know, this is not, the pair density wave and the charge density wave are not distinct by symmetry. So we haven't detected a pure pair density wave. It's not a new phase of matter. But the question still stands, is there somewhere in the phase diagram at high magnetic field or at higher temperatures above TC where we do? So how might we go about finding this? And this is not a comprehensive or exhaustive list, but it is a few ways you might want to start going about doing this. So the first thing you might immediately think of is, oh, well, we can go and do scan Josephson tunneling microscopy above TC. But it turns out that at such elevated temperatures, from what we know, the Josephson tunneling signal would be unmeasurably small. So that's not really a starter. What might be more promising, though, is to do scan Josephson tunneling microscopy as a function of doping. And if you see the modulating component grow to be a very large proportion of the uniform component as you go under dope, then that'd be a pretty strong pointer towards the fact that you do indeed have a pure pair density wave somewhere in the phase diagram. The second approach is to, rather than looking directly at the pairing modulations, look at the charge density modulations which they induce. Specifically, look at which charge density modulation wave vectors there are and how this changes when you go from above to below TC. So just to sort of flesh that out a bit, you need to look at the symmetry allowed couplings between pair density wave and charge density modulations. The first relevant one is that a pair density wave with wave vector Q couples linearly to charge density modulation of wave vector 2Q. So if I have a pair density wave with wave vector Q, it gives me a charge density modulation at 2Q. The second relevant one is that if I have a pair density wave at wave vector Q and a uniform superconductor, that couples linearly to a charge density wave of wave vector Q. So if I have a pair density wave of wave vector Q and a uniform superconductor, I get a charge density modulation at wave vector Q. So what I'd be looking for is, if I have a pair density wave with wave vector Q above TC, I get charge density modulation at wave vector 2Q. Then when I go below TC, I get an additional subharmonic at wave vector Q. You can look for this in your favorite probe, STM, neutron, X-ray, whatever. And if you see it, it's a pretty clear signature that you do, in fact, have a pair density wave. Rather than using temperature as a tuning parameter, you could use magnetic field. And that's something we've been looking at doing at Cornell. What you do is take two STM data sets, identical in every way, except one is taken with a magnetic field on and one taken with no magnetic field. And then you register them to each other using an image morphing algorithm so that the atoms are aligned with each other with picometer registration. Well, that one's disappeared. Anyway, that would be a topograph of taken 8.25 Tesla. That's the corresponding one at 0 Tesla. And then if you take the difference, you just get noise everywhere except for the sites where you get superconducting vortices. But we don't just have to do topography, we can do spectroscopy as well. So here I'm going to show you a movie which the color scale is some derivative of the density of states, time is energy, and this is taken at 8 Tesla, 0 Tesla, and this is the difference between them. And what you'll be able to see are clear magnetic field induced changes in the density of states at the site of vortices. And why this might be a good avenue for trying to detect a pair density wave is that In the halo surrounding the vortex core, we're going to expect the modulating component and the uniform component of superconductivity to become comparable in magnitude. This is where you're going to get the largest charge density subharmonic to look for. So this might be the place where we're going to get the best chance of seeing this smoking gun signature of a pair density wave. And the final approach I want to put forward is comparison of realistic calculations of the spectral function with experiment. So even when you have a uniform superconducting component coexisting with a pair density wave below TC, and it's not symmetry distinct from a charge density wave, they are very different microscopic states. And so you'd expect there to be a difference in their spectral functions. So comparing realistic calculations of that spectral function of the experiment could lead to a convincing signature of a pair density wave. So that's where I'm going to stop, and thanks for your attention.
So thank you. And I've been encouraged to be a bit biased in picking questioners to encourage some diversity, especially in age, if not gender. So, questions?
Whoever didn't ask question also count in terms of like question asking aid.
I guess I was wondering, the other signature you might look for is have dislocations in this pair density wave?
Yeah, I didn't mention that, but that's another thing, yeah.
So, but you obviously haven't seen any.
No, not yet. We haven't really, I'm not sure how to look for that. Using STM, no. Definitely not in the superconducting state.
Well, I guess there may be a spatial resolution challenge, since you've got to match the pieces up for that.
Here. So you have several other things that have spatial modulation in these samples. So the you see scattering, which has roughly the same wave vectors. You also see other things which are more static, which also have roughly the same vector, same wave vectors.
Yeah.
How do all of these things relate to each other in space? Are they somehow correlated to each other, or they're just independent of each other? So if I take,
we don't
for
know
example,
for sure, because it's actually. So you might want to say simultaneously measure these kind of ladder pattern type things and make this Josephson measurement. But we haven't been able to do that so far because the superconducting tip is quite extended.
I see.
So if you try and measure something like this, which has this D-wave intra-unit cell structure, it just averages it out and you don't see anything.
I see. So if you just measure scattering, for example, it would look like a plain whiteboard.
We've tried to look at quasi-particle interference, and we don't have a very good signal using the superconducting tip.
I see.
Yeah. So we did try to look at those correlations, and it's not something that was conclusive. Yeah. What we did do is try and account for how these could maybe imprint on the Josephson signal. Could they be causing the Josephson signal? And the way we account for that is by measuring the normal state resistance of the junction. So we look at the ICRN product. So that gets rid of that effect.
What is
RN? It's the quasi-particle resistance of the junction outside of the gap.
That has normalization.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for the nice talk, Steve. Just a quick question. So presumably, you could also either by accident or purposefully change the angle between these two, right? Between the sensing flake and the substrate. And presumably, if you go to like a 45 degree out of phase rotation, you should probably lose then the pair density wave signal. Or did you ever look into the angle between the flake and the substrate?
Yeah, we did.
So what happened?
And the only way we could approach that was looking at the topography. So if you have a very large mismatch in the crystallographic axes between your sample and your tip, then you don't expect to see any atomic contrast in your topography. If you have a very small mismatch, you expect to see moiré-type fringes. If they're aligned with each other perfectly, you just expect to see atomic contrast with no fringes. In all the examples of superconducting tips we have, we've only ever seen them being aligned, the crystallographic axes.
Is that not very coincidental or strange?
Well, you did pick it out of the same sample. I don't know if there's any talk there. No, we have to use elbow grease to rotate things. It's a big rod that comes down through the cryostat. Yeah.
So I got a bit confused about what you propose to be a smoking gun to distinguish, you know, PDW from a uniform plus PDW. You mentioned something. You mentioned this detecting the 2Q modulation of the CDW. But if I have CDW with Q, by itself is going to generate a subharmonic 2Q.
No, what I was saying was...
Why not?
You
subharmonic.
Yeah.
That's right.
No, so...
It
was
generates harmonics. This is a subharmonic, right? Can generate.
Okay.
So
apparently I'm wrong. I'll look at it. I don't know.
If you have a pair density wave that has wave vector Q, it will give you a charge density wave of wave vector 2Q above TC. But when you go below TC, it will give you a charge density wave of wave vector Q. So you have something that will appear in the superconducting state.
Do you think that they already have a CDW wave vector Q? That's what I'm saying.
No. You would only see it below TC. It would appear. We haven't seen it yet. So a concrete example would be you have a charge density wave with 4 unit cell periodicity. You go into the superconducting state, and you need to find something with 8 unit cell periodicity. You can't get that just from a charge density wave.
Can you detect a pair density wave or only the phase changing in space and not the amplitude?
Oh, so like an LO phase. Not with Skan-Josephs and tunneling as it's implemented here. It's actually not phase sensitive in that respect because we're looking at incoherent Cooper pair tunneling. And if you were to look in single particle tunneling in STM, then you shouldn't expect to see any periodic features because you can't make some gauge invariant quantity that modulates.
Yeah, in the FFLO scenario, FFLO arises because you're competing with the condensation energy and the spin polarization energy. So that happens under the Zeeman field. So you can tell the energy competition between the two mechanisms. Here you have temperature or magnetic field, which is C-axis, I guess. So orbital effect. So I wonder what's the underlying mechanism that favors better than the competing the condensation energy of the superconductor, uniform superconductor?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure there.
What about theories?
It's a particularly convincing reason why it should be lower energy than the uniform.
I understand is if there's anything that better than the uniform superconductor. I mean, that's how the FFLO rises, traditional FFLO. So there must be something behind. And initially, I thought that you want to have a charge density wave in one layer. The picture that you show. One layer and the other layer, and if you want to tunnel them, then you could have some pair density wave. But if you don't even see CDW, I'm just trying to understand what's the. Maybe Steve can answer because he's been keep talking about pair density wave, and I still don't get it. Where, with what mechanism that any ideas?
So the motivation for pair density wave is purely phenomenological. We've tried extremely hard to find a sensible microscopic mechanism, and so far it's missing.
I was going to ask a question, but let me first comment. At least we have one in terms of mechanisms. My question is this. Suppose you go above TCs and into the normal state.
Yeah.
Correct my confusion. I thought that in the same regime, your group previously said that there is a bond charge order. So you have two, you have both bond charge order and pair density wave order. Or what's the interplay between the two?
For them to be consistent, above TC, the bond order you see would have to be the 2Q harmonic.
This is when one induces the other, but suppose that both exist. It's more a question about experiments than about theory.
Okay.
So how's what you tell us now, telling us now, is related to what we knew from your group before about bond order? Do they exist in the same range of temperature slash dopings, or?
Yeah.
So we have both.
Yeah, we haven't measured any pairing modulation.
Yeah, so just a comment. If you had pure FFLO in your sample and you were tunneling from an ordinary superconductor, then you know the Josephson effect would have to be suppressed because you need momentum transfer. So I would think that's another smoking gun.
Okay. Yeah.
So.
Oh, you're talking about conserving the momentum of the Cooper pair.
Because you're tunneling from zero Cooper pairs to finding one other Cooper pair, and you would have a suppression.
So, any more questions? If not, let's thank Steve once more. Thank you.